From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chen Guangcheng, China's blind lawyer who fought against harsh measures to enforce China's one-child policy, including forced abortions, made an amazing escape from house arrest a week ago and ended up, we're told, under the protection of U.S. diplomats in Beijing. Now what? Hillary Clinton and Timothy Geithner are headed into talks right now in Beijing seeking China's cooperation on Iran, Syria, North Korea, and the global economy. And there stands lawyer Chen, symbol of human rights and the rule of law. This hour on Point, escape big issues and the difficult conversation ahead between the U.S. and China. You can join the conversation. Have you followed the harrowing story of a blind lawyer in China, the issues his case has raised? What should happen now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Chen had spent 51 months in prison, then was under house arrest, surrounded by thugs. We'll talk about how that works in China. April 22nd, apparently, over the wall he went, and it has been some kind of situation since then, just getting bigger and bigger as top American officials arrive in China. Last weekend, a fellow activist, Hu Jia, well-known, spoke with the BBC about how Chen made his escape. Hu Jia himself was later detained for questioning. Here he is.
First, he said Chen tried to dig a tunnel. It failed. So when a guard wasn't looking, he scaled a series of walls. He fell and hurt his leg. He called a supporter and was driven hundreds of miles to Beijing, the authorities giving chase to the American embassy.
It's a mind-boggling story, and things have not been easy since this escape for supporters of Chen. Here's Zheng Xinyan, wife of Hu Jia, talking with the BBC on Sunday from Beijing about the dangers that face Chen's family now that he's escaped. Her husband was being detained by authorities at the time of this interview.
We are very, very worried because Chen Guangcheng's wife was heavily beaten up several times, and her bones were broken, and we knew very clear what could happen. Even now, police are waiting downstairs asking me to talk to them, but I don't want to talk to them anymore.
The police waiting downstairs, right there as that interview was done. Barbara Demick is Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Her paper was very early in reporting Chen's escape, maybe the first. Barbara, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lo.
Who is this man?
He is a brave symbol of Chinese resistance. People tend to call him an activist, but he really isn't an activist or a dissident. He's an honest lawyer who began some years ago representing women who were opposing forced abortions and forced sterilizations. He was doing his job as a lawyer. He's an amazing guy. He's been blind since early childhood, taught himself law, and was really just doing his job.
Well, let's go back. He spent a long time in prison, 51 months we're reading here. And on what charges?
They accused him of creating a public disturbance, damaging public property. It was a very trumped-up charge because he really didn't do anything illegal. Basically, he followed the law, and China does have certain protections written into their laws. Nothing that he did was technically against the law. By the way, forced abortions and forced sterilizations are illegal in China. He was trying to make sure China followed the law.
He got out of prison, but not exactly. I mean, he was under house arrest in Shandong province. How does that work in China, and how did it work in his case?
Well, house arrest was not being told to stay at home. They made sure he stayed at home, and they turned his house into a virtual prison. They surrounded it with concertina wire. They put metal shutters, various devices so that they could spy on him. I've seen various figures, but they spent a lot of money, 8 million RMB, a couple million dollars, to build a prison around this house arrest. And, you know, something that I would point out is I always hear in these stories, authorities. These were local authorities who were embarrassed by his revelations. This was not the Chinese government in Beijing. This was, you know, to be honest, thugs, mostly plainclothes, police or non-police who didn't know like what he was doing and felt he had embarrassed the local Communist Party chieftains.
They would be embarrassed because the forced abortions or sterilization that he was helping women complain about presumably had happened in this area.
Yes, yes, there had been a very aggressive campaign in Linyi in counter to Chinese law. I mean, as we know, China has a very strict family planning law. Mm-hmm. One child, you know, unless there are extenuating circumstances, first child for some peasants, a girl. I don't think I need to go through all this.
Right.
But there are laws in China. This is not a lawless country. But the problem you have is that often on a local level, they're not followed.
And this was not legal detention then, but it was a fierce kind of detention. It's not unusual for this to happen in China, as far as I know. It's not exactly police outside his house, just sort of guys in leather coats, thugs they're often called, and lots of them.
Yeah, yeah, and this is a whole system in China where you see these extrajudicial measures taken. People are brought to quote-unquote black jails. That might be a hotel with no electricity and running water. It may be your own home. It may be a psychiatric institution. But there's a lot of things that are done that are not on the books. And this is bringing to a head a lot of the problems with the lack of rule of law in China. It's often done on the local level by, the locals who are embarrassed and want to cover up their own previous mistakes.
Chen is said to have feigned illness, stayed in bed, but then after a failed tunnel attempt to have, in the middle of the night, climbed over a wall or a number of walls, spent, we're reading here, 20 hours searching, trying to get to a rendezvous point. How does a blind guy do that? Then was driven 300-plus miles to Beijing by supporters who themselves are now, in detention. Where is he now? What's actually known? The first word was he's in the U.S. Embassy. It seems more nuanced than that now.
I've been told he's under U.S. protection. Is that the embassy? Is that the ambassador's residence? Some other diplomatic property? Consulate? I'm not really sure. They've been very quiet about that for obvious reasons. I drove by the ambassador's residence over the weekend and saw no signs of anything amiss. Possible they've moved him, but he is under U.S. protection.
But that really is only solid, isn't it, if he's in the embassy? I mean, just being with an American official in China doesn't amount to protection. The Chinese police could come straight up and arrest him, even into an apartment, couldn't they?
I think the ambassador's residence would qualify as a diplomatic property.
So there's been a lot of talk about trying to find some way out of this. There's a big agenda that Hillary Clinton and Geithner and more are arriving for. What's the way to thread this needle, or is there one, given how fraught his situation is?
Well, you know, it really is a perfect storm of everything coming together at once. As you may recall, in 2009, when Hillary Clinton made her maiden trip to Beijing as Secretary of State, her big thing was let's not let human rights get in the way of the real issues, economics and cooperation. And now, you know, these words are coming back to bite her. There's a funny twist on this. I'm sorry if we journalists find things funny, but Chen Guangcheng doesn't really want to leave China. And from what we're hearing, there was a deal made to somehow gracefully get him out of China. He's a thorn in the side of the Chinese government. As long as he's there and under house arrest, lots of people going to protest. But he is apparently saying, according to some of his supporters, no, I don't want to leave. I want to stay in China and fight for my rights as a Chinese citizen. Certainly if he leaves, he has a wife, he has a 6-year-old daughter and a mother. He's not going to leave his whole family behind. So these negotiations are going to be very, very tricky indeed. It's not as simple as, well, for example, Fang Lijie, who was the last dissident brought out in, I think, 1990. It's not as simple as putting him on a plane. They have to negotiate a satisfactory arrangement where his rights are protected in his own country if he stays.
That sounds like a tall order. Are you sure he'll have a choice here? I mean, if it's Chinese prison or the U.S., And the U.S., I mean, the U.S. has sent people out before, right? The consulate in Chongqing, the Bo Xilai guy who came.
No, this is a very important point. In this recent case, a local police official, Wang Lijun, went to the U.S. consulate in Chengdu complaining about all sorts of wrongdoing and was not given asylum and was sort of sent out on his way, although arrangements were made mm-hmm. to take him safely to Beijing. That just happened a few months ago, and you have a congressional committee investigating the U.S. handling of the case. So the State Department is under a lot of pressure to do the right thing on this one.
And the Chinese government's attitude toward Mr. Chen right now?
I think they would like him to just disappear and go away, and the easiest way to do that is to get him out of the country. I personally believe there has been some sort of deal to send him into exile in the United States, and that perhaps he does not want to take the deal.
Wow.
I'm flying a little bit blind here, sorry the pun, but I think that's part of the holdup.
Barbara Demick, Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, in New York today speaking with us. But Barbara, we're very grateful for your time. Thank you so much.
Sure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with the blind Chinese legal activist Chen Guangcheng, now in the middle of U.S.-China relations. We're looking at his daring escape, his work, the meaning of lawyer Chen here. President Obama did not use his name, but he was asked about this case at his press conference yesterday and responded like this.
Every time we meet with China, the issue of human rights comes up. It is our belief that not only is that the right thing to do because it comports with our principles and our belief in freedom and human rights, but also because we actually think China will be stronger.
Putting the best face on a really tricky situation, even trickier for Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, headed into talks in Beijing. Here she was at a press conference yesterday. Again, no name Mr. Chen used here, but you'll hear.
A constructive relationship includes talking very frankly about those areas where we do not agree, including human rights. That is the spirit that is guiding me as I take off for Beijing.
And here, a video released on Friday. Now, this was from Chen Guangcheng himself. And he talks in the video from where it was made, how it was made. I don't know where he was at the time. Nobody knows. It was set under protection of the U.S. But he tells of his escape, and he calls on China's premier, Wen Jiabao, to get involved here. Here he is. This is in Chinese, but with a voiceover, the man himself, Chen Guangcheng, with a voiceover by the BBC.
Dear Premier Wen, I finally escaped. As a witness, all the rumors on the internet, all the accusations of the violence against me and my family, they're all true. In fact, the truth is even worse than this. Premier Wen, you should intervene in this matter yourself. Please send an investigation team to find out the truth about the violence against me and my wife, to ensure the safety of my family according to law.
The voice there of Chen Guangcheng on a video released on Friday. He is said to be under protection of U.S. diplomats in Beijing and in the middle of a big tangle between two big powers. Joining us now from New York is Jerome Cohen. He's co-director of New York University School of Law's U.S. Asia Law Institute, senior fellow of Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a longtime confidant and supporter of Chen Guangcheng himself, and a big advocate for China's grassroots legal activist community. Jerome Cohen, thank you very much. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from New York is Sharon Hamm, executive director of Human Rights in China, which promotes democratic reforms in China, offices in New York and Hong Kong. She's professor of law emerita at the City University of New York School of Law, a board member of Human Rights Watch Asia. Sharon, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Jerome, what's the significance of this case?
Well, the significance lies in many respects. One is this individual, who is a magnificent person, mustn't be let down. We have to see that he lives a secure and positive, satisfying life. The significance also lies in what he and many others can do for law reform in China. This is an opportunity that should be seized, but not only by the U.S. government, but by the Chinese government, to have a positive outcome here that will be consistent with promoting the rule of law, as the leaders constantly claim they want to do. So I think the prospects are still bright after very, very intensive negotiation for an outcome that will keep Chun in China, that will give him his long-wished opportunity to study law, and that will give him an opportunity for freedom of speech like other Chinese citizens should have according to their constitution.
To study law, you say he's described as a self-taught lawyer. I think you brought him the books that he worked with to do that, but he's never formally studied?
No, and he's not a lawyer. He's a legal advocate. Mm-hmm. He's what we call a barefoot lawyer. But he just hungrily reads all these books. There are a lot of good how-to-do-it books on law and litigation in China, probably more good ones than we have in our own system. I bought him $100 worth about 9 years ago, and after I visited his village, I saw how well-fingered those copies were. And his wife and his oldest brother would read to him. And they developed de facto a kind of family barefoot lawyer law firm. And the brother sometimes would go to court when Chun would be out of town. And they all were familiar with the legal system in a very practical, down-to-earth county court level.
I want to look at the details of what happened with Mr. Chen. But, Sharon, between his formal imprisonment and his sort of house arrest surrounded by concertina wire, Barbara Demick tells us, and thugs, it's clear that somehow he's a threat to Chinese authorities. Why?
Well, first, I think it's in the DNA of the party, the Communist Party of more than 60 years, that you can see it clearly. There's a profound discomfort with the flow of information, a profound need to control it. You can see it this week in the blocking of blind person, even Chen Guangcheng's initials, the prefecture, Linyi, that he lives, embassy was blocked, but also
you mean online?
Yes, online in the Chinese website. Mm-hmm. The names of the 9 standing committees are blocked. Even Mao Zedong was blocked, Jiang Zemin was blocked, but not Lin Biao and Liu Shaoqi, who had been purged by the party. So why are they so frightened of this one very courageous blind rights defender? It's in the DNA to be nervous and distrustful of its own people. You can see it in the whole campaign of Wei Ran, which is their whole campaign of stability maintenance, spending really billions of yuan in this trying to maintain control and security. And, you know, just yesterday, Tom, at Fudan University, the propaganda chief of the People's Daily, he pointed out all of these blockings and said that this is an example of a correct handling and maintaining of a correct public opinion and leading the masses in the correct
by blocking all references to anything approaching Mr. Chen online so Chinese can't chat about it, talk about it, learn about it.
Yes, they were saying specifically not of the direct blocking, but he said, we have handled the situation. Now, if you see how they handle the situation, the People's Daily earlier in last month issued an editorial on what the correct position was during the Bo Xilai incident, and that was to reemphasize as a headline op-ed in all the party papers and in the commercial papers and in the so-called independent private papers. They carried the same editorial, and the editorial was, we believe in rule of law. And did we say rule of law? And again, we believe in rule of law. So that kind of protests is so vigorously that this is a rule of law, you know, it goes back to your question. What are they afraid of? Well, they're afraid of and what they know. And what they know is that the whole system of which Chen Guangcheng's rampant, the way that his family and his supporters have been abused, is symptomatic and reflective of not just one case in China. It is reflective of a pervasive, rampant, the corruption and abuse and the widespread illegal arrogance of thugs feeling that nobody can touch them. So they're afraid that that truth is going to get out. And obviously, they can't see what a blind person can see. That what is so obvious is for them to deal with the situation is not to give in to their own DNA fears, but that they really need to address the core of the problems. And these are the problems that Chen Guangcheng and other defenders have been raising.
Sharon, Jerome, there's clearly a problem here. Now, and I want to look at the details of that. And, I mean, we're hearing about beatings of Chen and his wife and trouble even for his young daughter. But for just a minute, to step back sympathetically, look at the very big picture. China has struggled for a long time to deal with a gigantic population, and which it feared, I guess, would overwhelm its resources and just be impossible. You know, it passed a billion and just kept on going. And he wanted to bring a class action lawsuit on behalf of women who got on the wrong side of that policy. Maybe China just made a decision at the top level. They couldn't deal with the kind of population that Mr. Chen's action would produce if that's where things went.
There's no problem with the policy of birth control. The problem is how is it executed? What the police did and their thugs and other associates was to round up the families of women who had fled to avoid forcible abortion.
Because they were pregnant for a second time, typically? Would that be the issue? Or why would they be fleeing?
There are many holes in this family policy. In some places in China, indeed, they want to abandon it because, like Shanghai, they aren't producing enough people. But the fact was, instead of using legal measures, these local authorities resorted to all kinds of horrible ways, rounding up whole families, grandparents, children, cousins, whatever, and abusing them. A few were killed. Many were harmed physically. And the last time I saw Chen, he was very, very anxious and nervous about his inability to get the courts or any local authorities or any central authorities to do anything to stop this. I'd never seen him before so depressed and anxious.
And local authorities were upset, Jerome, because they wouldn't be hitting their local targets for population control. So they'd be in trouble with central authorities? Is that the idea?
Well, and they would lose their perks. They would lose their ability to get promoted. There are a lot of sanctions that when they have to choose between their personal careers and the rights of other people, they ignore the central government's criminal procedure laws and other protections of individuals, and they do what they think they have to do. And in the end, the central government backed them up. This has not been a new issue in China. In 2005, I wrote a public plea to the Minister of Public Security, who's now the head of the whole party political legal system, asking, is this the way a civilized country's government should behave?
He was forced abortion and forced sterilization and beatings.
Yes, and not only that. The treatment of Chen and his family. He was already locked up in his own home before they decided to use formal criminal punishment. The reason they prosecuted him was many of us exposed the fact there was no legal basis for imprisoning him at home.
But this is not as rare as you might think. I mean, we've been talking since On Point went to Shanghai, looked at all kinds of issues. You talked with us then about how things work. And we heard stories very similar to this of lawyers, advocates locked up, beaten, their families intimidated, beaten worse by just guys in black leather jackets.
Yep, and it's still going on, and it's getting worse. In the last 5 years, of course, the policy of expanding the legal system only exists at the theoretical level. In practice, they've been reverting to a much more repressive regime.
I want to hear from our listeners. Let's go to Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and Eric. Eric, thanks for calling. What do you think? You're on the air.
Hey there, Tom. Love the show. This is the first time I've actually heard this story. I know I probably need to catch up a little bit more, but a couple things kind of rubbed me wrong, initial reaction here. Internet blockage thing, I know that's been going on a while, but it really just blows my mind that they're blocking even that. You know, they're blocking people searching for him. There's so many people in China, and all these laws are not homogenous, you know, all the way through. They're applied differently in local areas, and I don't know, it just rubs me the wrong way, all this corrupt stuff going on with the government and thug protection, and now we're trying to go over there and be diplomatic and help with their own social human rights issues. And
what should the U.S. do? Should we get deeply involved? Should we say, China, no way you're going to have this guy back? How hard should the U.S. stand up for Mr. Chen?
I think sometimes it's all or nothing for Americans and maybe even our diplomacy. So I think we should just go with nothing. I think it's just kind of a messed up situation, and we should just stay out of it.
Stay out of it. Okay, we've got it, Eric. That's going to be hard to do with the Secretary of State right there, but there's the advice. Yvonne in Providence, Rhode Island. Yvonne, you're on the air.
Hi. I also think that we should stay out of this problem because the Chinese have the right to control their, to want to control their population. The less national they have, the better off they will be.
Yvonne, forced abortion, forced sterilization?
Forced abortion and forced sterilization. I'm sorry. This is not quite right, but this is the way it is. Maybe in 20 or 25 years, the world will not have enough supplies to feed all these people.
Yvonne, we've got it. Sharon Hamm, there you go. First two callers, you know, stay out of it. It's their business. How do you hear Sharon?
I can understand that, you know, if one, you know, isn't quite informed of what the U.S. obligations are. And in fact, the U.S. and China has obligations that are international. So in other words, the human rights issues, unfortunately, for the last 60 more years, really are not domestic issues. And in Chen Guangcheng's case, a little known fact that back in November 2006, when he was first picked up and then subsequently served 4 years and 3 months prison sentence, an independent UN body of experts, which China participated in, rendered a decision and said that his detention violated international norms. And the whole 19 months that he has been under quote-unquote house arrest is in complete violation of Chinese law as well as international law. So for the U.S. To stay out of it would not only be incredibly irresponsible of the U.S. to its own obligations, but it also has an impact on U.S. interests. So you'd have to be very short-sighted to think that ignoring human rights issues, even if they thought they could, would not have an adverse impact on U.S. security and trade interests.
Or global culture around law, ultimately. But, Jerome, there's our first two callers with a kind of pragmatic response. You know, China's a big country. China's a big power. It's all or nothing. It better be nothing, then. Let's stay out of it. What do you say to that, Jerome?
Well, that's totally unrealistic. Where we are is, and we're in very close cooperation and interchange with China on a whole host of issues. We need their help. They need our help. And we have to get over these problems that occur between us. This man shows up on the embassy doorstep, and we have to decide what to do. And in order to save him and arrange an orderly future with the Chinese government, we had to give him temporary shelter. He's not been charged with any new crime in China now. He's not a fugitive. He's simply a guest now at the U.S. Embassy, and there are discussions with the Chinese want to take part in to try to work out some positive outcome. I'm all for China's need for birth control, but the question is how to do it. It doesn't involve in violating the human rights of many, many millions of people in China.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the blind Chinese legal activist Chen Guangcheng, now right in the middle of U.S.-China relations, looking at his daring escape, his work, the meaning of Chen Guangcheng this hour. Jerome Cohen is with us. He's co-director of the New York University School of Law, U.S.-Asia Law Institute, has spent years working to promote an active and good legal system in China, and a confidant of Mr. Chen himself. Sharon Hamm is with us from New York, executive director of human rights in China. Very active there. Jerome Sherman got lots of response here online. Castle says, yay, lawyers. For all the bad propaganda, it's lawyers, barefoot and otherwise, on the front lines of protection of human rights. From Chen to the ACLU to Human Rights Watch to the Pakistanis' judges revolt. Lawyers respect the law, risk themselves to see it made fairly and applied fairly. Here's Zheng Liu writes to us. Mr. Chen belongs to a rare species in the history of Chinese brutal political repression. Only comes up once in a great while, a model for generations of Chinese, Zheng writes. Very few of his kind stand up to the oppressors and insist on taking back unalienable rights. But we've got a lot of along this line. Hands-on writes to us, I struggle with our government, the U.S. government, calling out other countries on human rights abuses. We have 1 in 100 people in this country in prison. We torture our prisoners of war. We're killing hundreds of innocent civilians in Pakistan and Yemen with drone attacks. How about we get our own house in order before we run around telling the rest of the world about human rights? What do you say to that, Jerome?
I say I agree with both points. Certainly the great endorsement of the courage of lawyers and barefoot lawyers in China is right on point. And we do everything possible we can, and I hope others will continue to expand their support for these people. On the other point, of course, we can't say to the world, including China, do as we say, not as we do. It's an embarrassment to those of us who work in the field of human rights in China that occasionally we have these very severe problems in the United States. They're more limited in many ways, and they're different, but they are human rights problems. And we have to do much more than our government has recently done to carry out our own obligations. But we can't wait while many of our colleagues work in the American domestic human rights field to cure these problems. We can't wait to deal with problems that are thrust upon us by the world and our contacts with China. So I think we have to walk on two legs, as Chairman Mao once admonished us to do. On the one hand, do our best to cooperate with China and the Chinese people in the development of a legal system and human rights. On the other hand, we have to be very sensitive in practice as well as in theory to protect human rights better in the United States.
Walk on two legs. We're quoting Chairman Mao here. Craig in Davenport, Iowa. Craig, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up this issue of I've heard some callers bringing up, cultural relativism in terms of, let China do what they do. That is their own system. That is their own culture. To me, that seems very backwards. This is a human rights issue with the type of Chinese government that uses its people as a means to its own end. It's just backwards.
So one standard, you say, one standard when it comes to human rights globally.
Go ahead again. Sorry about that.
You're saying let's have one standard when it comes to human rights globally?
No. Not necessarily one standard. What they're trying to do, it seems like, and it has been for a while, is that the political ideology that they're trying so hard to hold on to is taking precedence over the rights of the people that live in that nation.
Yeah.
Issues in terms of abortion, forced sterilization, things like that. These factors, these notions of population control, although some may be very relevant, they're using them to keep that system of government and society alive because they aren't paying livable wages. They aren't allowing people to live their own lives.
Craig, we've got it. You say no to cultural relativism then when we look at that, and we've got that. Let me get a couple more if I may. Jessica in Arlington, Massachusetts. Jessica, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I there were several people, the first two calls that you had taken,
mm-hmm.
I was about to pull right over because I feel like my opinion is completely different. I mean, we are Americans, I'm an American, and Americans stand up for people. They should be standing up for people who cannot speak for themselves. And forced sterilization or let's leave it alone, let's not get involved, is just ridiculous. And I feel so strongly that we do need to do something. I realize it's not an all or nothing game, but I just feel so strongly that this country, for so many people in this world, we represent, a real standard. And I just feel like we have to fight for these people who cannot speak for themselves.
Jessica, we've got it, and we hear your passion right behind it. And if I may, let me get one more, and I thank you, Jessica. Barbara, Amherst, Massachusetts. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I feel there's not very much as an individual that I can do. But one thing I refuse to do while China so abuses human rights is travel to China. I just don't see reason why I should spend my money in a country that so abuses its people, and I think that it, on a one-person basis, it doesn't do much, but it's my own little personal approach.
You're ready to take a personal stand. No trip to China for you, and we've got it. And one more. Elaine, and thank you, Barbara. Windsor, Connecticut. Elaine, you're on.
Hi. This is my first time listening to your program, and this is a very interesting topic. I think that the United States is doing the right thing to step in to help someone who seems to be overwhelmed by authority, overwhelmed by the government in his own country. And sometimes we just need that bigger brother, bigger sister to step in to help us out, especially when it comes down to the issue of human rights. I think the United States is doing the right thing to step in.
Elaine, we've got it. Sharon Hull, let me come back to you here. You know what a groaning board of issues Hillary Clinton and Tim Geithner are taking to Beijing. I mean, they've got, what, North Korea and its nukes on there. They've got Syria and, you know, uproar there. They've got Iran in a potential in a nuclear program. They've got the global economy. You know, are they really going to put Mr. Chen on the scales against all that and say we need China's cooperation, but we may have to walk away from it in order to save this one guy?
Well, I wouldn't venture to guess what the internal behind the doors geopolitical horse trading is going on for the deal. I think that's a lot of, but I think the important thing is no matter what the outcome is of this particular. Of how they will handle Chen Guangcheng's this very complex situation. The reality is that the big issues, the big picture, is going to remain. And I want to say two quick things about your caller's comments, because I thought they were very good. On cultural relativism, it's important to note that the Chinese government itself has said publicly that human rights are universal, indivisible, and of one piece. At the same time, when they raise cultural relativism, it is really for the purpose of saying they define what culture is. And that's to silence like 1.3 billion Chinese who are trying to shape our own culture. The people who can't speak for themselves point, some people cannot speak for themselves. But in this particular case, Chen Guangcheng has powerfully spoken for himself in his own voice. And his video is very powerful. And he's asking for support, not just for his own case, but to link. He names names, and he links his own abuses.
He names those in the sort of thugs outside his house who beat whom and when.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that he links that this personal, incredibly horrible abuses suffered by himself and his family are linked to the massive systemic corruption. So however this is resolved, he's made a direct request to Premier Wen Jiabao. That needs to be responded to. It has to be responded to by the premier and the leadership. What are they going to do about the systemic corruption that has provided the whole fuel for this kind of abuse so that it can't keep happening? So I think that's very important to raise. On Clinton and the big plate that is the whole security plate, the trade plates, that's true. They need the cooperation of China. But what kind of China? A China that is not accountable, that is corrupt, that doesn't have a rule of law, that is will not be a good security partner. What we need, what the U.S. needs as a partner in the region is a government that is accountable, that is democratic, that is not a thug government. That kind of government would be provide the kind of cooperation that other governments need in the region and in the world.
Jerome Patrick asks online, he says, is our financial relationship with China going to affect the outcome of this situation? Are we going to sell Chen out?
I don't think we're going to sell Chen out. I think whatever solution is arrived at whether he can stay in China, study law, develop some kind of a public interest law practice, express himself freely, that's going to require support. And it's going to require support, if not from either government, from foundations, Chinese and foreign foundations. So from that point of view, finance is important. If, on the other hand, he is forced to leave and he doesn't want to leave, he'll have to have some support while he and his family, if they're permitted to join him and come out, get their feet on the ground here. My hope is he will stay in China. He will study law. We will promote the rule of law. We certainly at NYU Law School are willing to cooperate with him in every way, as we cooperate with many units and people in China. And I think the Chinese government is really confronting a crisis of lawlessness. See, it's lawlessness that is at the heart of the Bo Xilai crisis in Chongqing.
This is the big figure in Chongqing who's very high, or was very high before he got kicked out of the Politburo, and charges of corruption there, but also charges that he was appealing to a sort of Maoist sensibility in what some Chinese see as a good sense, saying
yes, but with all the accompanying lawlessness of the Maoist regime, torture, abuse, many people have been executed unfairly. You don't have adequate opportunity for lawyers to defend them. Some lawyers have been punished. It was a scandal. And what Chun here has been protesting is the lawlessness that he and his family and many, many people in his home area have been subjected to. The Chinese leadership is confronted now by a crisis of lawlessness. Is it going to live up to all its professions of the need for a rule of law? It's very ironic that Bo Xilai, we're told, his case is being handled according to law. The fact is, his case isn't even in the legal system. It's being handled not according to law, but it's being handled by the Communist Party.
Yeah. Tom in Pownall, Vermont. Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah. I just like to point out the fact that, you know, everyone gets all up in arms when one individual speaks out in China, but we don't really seem to care when all this stuff's done behind closed doors. I mean, the fact that China abuses its citizens has been a fact for many, many years, and people just seem to care when it's brought into the popular media. They don't really seem to care when they're voting with their wallets out in the stores and they're able to get a stupid iPod or something for $2 cheaper because it's made in China by fingerless children.
That's a fair point, Tom, and it's something for everybody to contemplate as we go through this story, and I appreciate your call. Lionel in Montreal, Canada. Lionel, you're on.
Hi. I think the answer to the question you've been asking is, if the situation were reversed, what would, could, should the Chinese do?
You mean if we were putting, I don't know, what would the reversal look like? You know,
the closest thing I could think of was Guantanamo Bay, U.S. citizen being held for X number of months without being charged with anything, escapes and goes to the Chinese embassy for sanctuary.
Now that's interesting.
That's the
closest
I could get to.
Okay, I will take that. Jerome, what do you say? It's a long swim, but what if it happened?
Well, we would have to deal with it according to our own legal system and according to our international legal obligations.
But you've got a lot of people who said we've already been outside our own legal system over the last decade.
We have been subjecting our legal system to great challenges. The challenge is still being fought in our courts. And I have opposed decisions that have closed our courts to people with legitimate claims. And I hope that despite the divisions in our Supreme Court, that in the end, the Supreme Court will come up with the right solution, which is to have our legal system open to people who have the kinds of complaints we're talking about, and also that the United States would be called to account in various international forums.
Chen is a friend of yours, Jerome. So
he's
a close friend. You've got a personal relationship. I mean, in some ways, you raised his case in the Washington Post in a way that got some time ago, Chinese authorities pretty jangled. I mean, in some ways, you sort of raised him to the point where he may be more vulnerable now. You've got a lot at stake here. What should the world be learning from as we watch this unfold?
Well, we have a lot at stake in the outcome. We'll know something perhaps within 36 hours, at least for an interim solution. But I am optimistic that something positive will come out of it. You see, Chun is confronted with a choice. If he leaves China, if he can, and that may take years for that to come about, he won't play much of a role for the rest of his life. Dissidents and rule of law people who come abroad usually can't make it in our own society and persuade us about what's going on in China. If he stays in China, it's a risk. But he's 40 years old. He may have 30 or 40 years ahead of himself. If a deal can be worked out now that would allow him to join the growing groups of people working in civil society, people working in public interest law firms, if he can do what Ai Weiwei, the famous artist is now doing. Ai Weiwei is managing to really exercise considerable freedom of speech while still under government restraint.
Can you imagine this Chinese government permitting what you're describing there after all of this and this high profile? As Sharon says, they won't even let a mention of this man go on the internet. Can you imagine that kind of active public role for him sometime in the future, really?
Surprising things have happened, and I'm optimistic.
Well,
surprising things are happening, and we're just having to look in the right place and read the right microblogs, because the Chinese people are speaking up. So this is a time to do the right thing, which is, of course, standing up for law and protection of rights, but it's to be on the side of the numbers. And the numbers in China, Cheng Guangcheng is very special, and he also is not the only one.
Big spotlight. Sharon, we're out of time right there, but I so appreciate you being with us. Big spotlight on this case, and we'll all be watching with rapt interest as it unfolds. Sharon Han with Human Rights in China, joining us from New York. Sharon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jerome Cohen, it's always great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.